Part two. We are here continuing the discussion of the question of how space can be a symbol or representation of the ultimate. One thing which will perhaps help us to understand this use of the conception of space is to consider this fact, which was discussed at some length in the first part, namely, that space is viewed by us as the container of all things. We can also say, viewing the problem from the psychological aspect, that consciousness is the container of all objects. Since the function of consciousness is here akin to that of space, I think we may see how the transition from consciousness to space is rather natural. But we have to recognize two aspects of space, namely the perceptual space, which contains all things as entities, and the conceptual space, which is the space of the mathematician. But in both cases, we have the direct experience that our perceptual consciousness is the container of all objects. Note that now we shift from the notion of things to objects. The notion of things being a representation of supposed independent existence, unrelated to consciousness, a position which I believe to be demonstrably false, but nonetheless, a position which persists in our habits of thinking. Likewise, the conceptual space of the mathematician is really the conceptual consciousness, which is the container of the ideas of the mathematician. I think that perhaps here we have an indication of why consciousness should be so easily identified with the notion of space. We'll find that we have only proceeded partway in the identification of the root principle. And further quotation from the secret doctrine in the discussion of the first principle will help to introduce this point. So I shall continue to quote. Quoting, Herbert Spencer has of late so far modified his agnosticism as to assert that the nature of the first cause, which the occultist more logically derives from the causeless cause, the eternal and the unknowable, may be essentially the same as that of the consciousness which wells up within us. In short, that the impersonal reality pervading the cosmos is the pure noumenon of thought. This advance on his part brings him very near to the esoteric and Vedantin tenet. Parabrahman, the one reality, the absolute, is the field of absolute consciousness, namely that essence which is out of all relation to conditioned existence, and of which conscious existence is a conditioned symbol. But once we pass in thought from this to us, absolute negation, duality supervenes in the contrast of spirit or consciousness and matter, subject and object. The end of the quotation for the moment. One point made here that is interesting is this, that namely, that Parabrahman, the one reality, the absolute, is the field of absolute consciousness. Here again, field is a reference that implies space. We may even speak of this pure consciousness, the consciousness without an object and without a subject, or consciousness in the sense of Rigpa, to use the Tibetan term employed in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is actually a field consciousness, not a relational consciousness. And as a field, it suggests right away the notion of space, that which is the container of entities and processes. These conceptions are difficult for us because, ordinarily, we deal with contents rather than with the container of the contents. We shift in to the dualistic kind of thinking inevitably, which presents this original reality as consisting of two aspects, namely spirit or consciousness and matter, or, in psychological terms, of the subject and the object. It is necessary to turn upon ourselves in terms of our consciousness so that we become aware of the consciousness itself rather than simply of the object of consciousness. And, as generally is the case, only inferentially of the subject of the consciousness. Continuing with the quotations, spirit or consciousness and matter are, however, to be regarded not as independent realities, but as the two symbols or aspects of the absolute, Parabrahman, which constitute the basis of conditioned being whether subjective or objective. We have here then a further step. It is not simply pure consciousness in the psychological sense with which we are here dealing in our view of the ultimate reality, but of a compound notion which involves both spirit or consciousness and matter. Matter not being quite identical with the object, which is its psychological equivalent, but as rather identical with a substance. In other words, consciousness may be viewed as a pure essence, matter as a substance, a something which is rather more than a psychological object. Let us continue with the quotation. Considering this metaphysical triad, namely the absolute and the subject and matter, as the root from which proceeds all manifestation, the great breath assumes the character of pre-cosmic ideation. It is the fons et origo of force and all individual consciousness, and supplies the guiding intelligence in the vast scheme of cosmic evolution. On the other hand, pre-cosmic root substance, Mula Prakriti, is that aspect of the Absolute which underlies all the objective planes of nature. We'll notice at this point we have not simply a duality, but a triad. We've introduced here the notion of threeness. And in this connection, I would like to remind you of the great emphasis on threeness made by the Buddha. All important statements appear repeated three times by him, and thus emphasizing this point. Thus, the ultimate is not to be viewed simply as one thing, or a compound of two aspects, but ultimately as a compound of three aspects. The third aspect now becomes clarified in further quotation. Quoting, just as pre-cosmic ideation is the root of all individual consciousness, so pre-cosmic substance is the substratum of matter in the various grades of its differentiation. Hence it will be apparent that the contrast of these two aspects of the Absolute is essential to the existence of the manifested universe. Apart from cosmic substance, cosmic ideation could not manifest as individual consciousness, since it is only through a vehicle, or upadhi, of matter, that consciousness wells up as I am I. a physical basis being necessary to focus a ray of the universal mind at a certain stage of complexity. Again, apart from cosmic ideation, cosmic substance would remain an empty abstraction, and no emergence of consciousness would ensue. Now here, the point is made still clearer. The universal consciousness requires the presence of universal substance in order that there can be a manifestation at all. Universal consciousness and universal substance by themselves are obstructions. They become actual only when viewed as interdependent and forming thus one entity. This suggests to us the psychosomatic conception which is familiar on a lower level. However much the psychosomatic conception may be inadequate, on that lower level, yet on the highest level, we must take this view if we are to understand this philosophy, namely, that there is no consciousness without substance, and no substance without consciousness. That the two are ultimately inseparable. Continuing the quotation, the manifested universe, therefore, is pervaded by duality, which is, as it were, the very essence of its existence as manifestation. But just as the opposite poles of subject and object, spirit and matter, are but aspects of the one unity in which they are synthesized, so in the manifested universe there is that which links spirit to matter, subject to object. End of that quotation. This now leads to the introduction of the third element. This third element that is the factor in uniting these two, consciousness, universal consciousness, and substance. Quoting, this something at present unknown to Western speculation is called by the occultists Fohat. It is the bridge by which the ideas existing in the divine thought are impressed on cosmic substance as the laws of nature. Fohat is thus the dynamic energy of cosmic ideation, or regarded from the other side, it is the intelligent medium, the guiding power of all manifestation, the thought divine transmitted and made manifest through the Dion Shoans, the architects of the visible world. Thus from spirit or cosmic ideation comes our consciousness. From cosmic substance, the several vehicles in which that consciousness is individualized and attains to self or reflective consciousness. While Fohat, in its various manifestations, is the mysterious link between mind and matter, the animating principle electrifying every atom into life. The end of the quotation. What we have now is a triune principle as the root of all. It is not to be regarded as a trinity of three elements, but rather as a oneness which is triune in its total nature. The three aspects thus are consciousness, in the root sense of a pure universal consciousness, which is not the consciousness of a self, and which is in its purity not a consciousness of a content, but a root consciousness. Second, an aspect as substance. It is a consciousness substance, not consciousness and substance. And finally, as the third facet of this root, the principle of dynamism, which in the language of the secret doctrine is called Fohat, but which is the basis of the whole energetic side of being. Its manifestation before us consists of all the forces in nature, including life, electricity, and all the other energetic side of the whole of manifested being. We have then three potential approaches to the root, in addition to that approach which is through consciousness or the one mind, as in the case of the sutra written by Padmasambhava. There is the potentiality of an emphasis upon the principle of substance, and this we would see well exemplified in the 10th letter of the Mahatma letters. On page 56, in the middle of the page, we find the following sentence. Quoting, "In other words, we believe in matter alone, in matter as visible nature, and matter in its invisibility, as the invisible, omnipresent, omnipotent Proteus, with its unceasing motion, which is its life, and which nature draws from herself, since she is the great whole, outside of which nothing can exist." End of quotation. This would sound a good deal like a materialistic statement, except for the fact that there is the reference to nature or matter in its subtle sense, which has been identified as Mula Prakriti or Akasha. It is therefore the principle of substance that is here emphasized. And the point would be that this is a line of development that is possible in that tri-unity consisting of consciousness, substance, and dynamism or Phohat. A third point of view and a third possibility is a philosophical point of view that is oriented primarily to life or the will or some other formulation of the principle of dynamism. All such philosophies would have to be construed as supplementary to each other, as by standing by themselves as only partial views of the whole. A totally comprehensive philosophic point of view would have to include all three approaches, namely, through an orientation to a universal consciousness. Second, an orientation to the principle of substance. And third, an orientation to the principle of dynamism, either under the conception of life or of will or of some other statement of the dynamic principle. We now can draw certain conclusions. In the light of this statement, we can attach a meaning to the assertion frequently made, namely, that thoughts are things. Thoughts are, first of all, a conscious process. To say that they are things is to recognize the fact that connected with any conscious process, there is also a substance. Certain implications follow from this, namely, that every thought of every thinking creature is also a production of an object not simply in the psychological sense, but also in the substantial sense, because the other side of the thought is substance. One could therefore assume that on the level of subtle perception, every thinking creature would have a community of objective existences which were in effect his creations. Since many of these creations are manifestly impure, they impose a problem for such an individual. They could also be pure and productive in a noble sense, and these would be the merit of such an individual. But while we could there attach meaning to the statement that thoughts are things, no less would it be true that to say that things are also thoughts. And the effect of this is to exalt matter into a more spiritual valuation. To say that thoughts are things, in a sense, is a degradation of thought, while on the other hand, to say that things are thoughts is an exaltation of matter or thinghood. From the thesis as so far developed, certain practical consequences follow. Of these, I will briefly consider three possibilities as follows. First, a new interpretation of the meaning of projection as a modern psychological term. Second, a theory of magic. And third, a statement of the reasons why control of thought becomes of premier importance. First, let us consider the implications concerning projection in the psychological sense. Ordinarily, I believe we view this projection as only psychological and quite insubstantial. It is simply like the experiencing of ideas, considered only as ideas and insubstantial in themselves. Typically, a projection may be produced by imposing a prejudice, such as we may have, upon someone else, another race, or whatnot. An example of projection in an important sense is afforded in the discussion of what happens in the bardo, as represented by the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and in the theosophical eschatology as to the Devakonic interlude, which it is said occurs after death. If thought, if a conscious idea all invokes along with it an actual substance, then projections such as those which are said to be seen shortly after death in the form of the benevolent gods and the gods of wrath are projections from our own consciousness, as we are warned that they are not real in themselves. But they're not wholly unreal in the light of our present theory. For these projected thoughts are real in the sense of consisting of actual substance, unreal in the sense of being independent existences. So we would have to speak of them as real, unreal. Not merely a figment of the imagination, but something that has a kind of existence. The same would apply to the Devakonic interlude, in which one has an environment, and in that environment all of his valued friends and relatives. But those friends and relatives, along with the environment, are projections. Again, in the light of our present thesis, real in a sense, namely, in the sense that they are composed of substance, unreal in the sense of being independent existences. They are rather the ideas or evaluations of such entities as given by the one who has entered into the Devakonic interlude. We thus have a meaning attaching to the hyphenated concept of real, unreal. Real in that they are in some sense substantial, though substantial in a subtle sense, not in the sense of gross matter. But unreal in that they are not centers of independent consciousness. Second, concerning a theory of magic. Inasmuch as that which we think in the light of the present thesis is also an invocation, as it were, of a substantial aspect of the thought. In other words, since that which we think is also a substance, even though we are not aware of it, then, by the power of thought, we can create existences that are real in the substantial sense. This differs from projection in the sense that it is conscious, whereas the projection is an unconscious event. Now, this appears to be so easily done on some subtle levels of matter that no special equipment is required or a special knowledge in order to produce either unconsciously a projected environment or even to create something consciously by conscious thinking. But if we knew the difference between subtle matter, such as that which is experienced in the death stage or even in the dream stage, and that which is experienced objectively here, and we knew the step by which a subtle creation could be objectified, we would have a mastery of magic. This would not in any way involve an abandonment of rationality, there would be nothing of miracle involved in it, but simply an appropriate action in accordance with law. We can see how, in principle, it might be possible to produce an object in the gross physical sense if one only knew the step from the subtle object produced by thought to what we might call the frozen state of substance, which is the form of matter as we know it here. And on the third point, concerning the importance of control of thought, if we produce entities or living or otherwise, unconsciously, by our thoughts, so that they exist in a subtle form of matter, then, when we pass into the bardo after death, we may expect to meet these. If our thoughts have been predominantly impure, then we could very well have prepared for ourselves an excruciatingly painful hell. On the other hand, if they have been pure and constructive and informative, then we could have produced a condition of very great satisfaction and delight. Control of thought, therefore, is highly important, and we can see why. This is emphasized in the voice of the silence. We have now, then, a rational approach to the whole possibility of these different types of possible experience. Indeed, we can see why it should be asserted, as Lord Northrop has pointed out, that the smoker, after he has died, smokes still cigars that are mind-made, and the drinker drinks liquor that is mind-made, and also other activities like feasting, like building, like any kind of constructive activity, can be projected creatively and consciously as an environment. We can see why it is in principle possible that the individual who has sufficient resources can produce a planet, which first would be a subtle construction, but which subsequently, by the process which we may call a certain freezing or objectivization, would become an actual planet. And he who created it would be its mono. These are just a few suggestions concerning the possibilities that grow out from this fundamental conception that consciousness, substance, and dynamism or energy is a threefold unity. The three parts, while separable for the purposes of thought, are not separable in reality, and therefore thought is a producer of things, and that becomes quite important.